I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Dom Giordano on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
Hey, everyone. Welcome into Speaker Series. You know, we've done a lot of them. The only other sports one that I did was Nick Foles at the height of that summer after the Super Bowl. So Ray Dittinger has some big shoes to fill, but the book, Finished Business, 50 Years of Headlines, Heroes, and Heartaches, is just a masterpiece. Ray, I commit, the best commendation I can give is I often don't have time to finish a book. This one I read it cover to cover, which is unusual. You know, in this business, you have to go through. I hear you with Glenn on the weekend, and people wouldn't know that you have. Well, wait a minute, though. There's five Emmys behind Ray Dittinger before we start here. Not to be pretentious. Wow. I have to get a few of those, Ray, and they're all from NFL Films.
They were, they're from my 13 years at NFL Films. Yeah, there's six of them back there. And it was, that was a really great chapter of my life. I mean, I never imagined that I would ever be a filmmaker. But Steve Sabol gave me that opportunity. And it was 13 wonderful years. I really enjoyed my time there.
Well, writer starting at the Delco Times, radio host, TV personality, filmmaker, and then maybe the hardest of all, I think, is the playwright. It's just amazing how that goes on and on and on. So I wanted to ask you, Ray, because knowing that you'd be on with us, we had a lot of people who are sports fans, but maybe not quite asking you about the third string quarterback 8 years from now, as they do at WIP, it's a bigger picture. What's the biggest change you've seen over those 50 years? And a good one or two, you know, too much. I know you try to emphasize some of the good ones with Glenn, not just the negative changes that have happened.
Well, man, so much, Dom. I mean, 50 years, man, it's a long time. I've seen a lot of change. Seen a lot of change in the sports, seen a lot of change in the way leagues do business, seen a lot of change in the athletes, a lot of change in the money.
That's the biggest driver, isn't it, of most of this stuff?
Probably so. Probably so. When I first started in the business, 1970 was my first year covering the Eagles. And for one thing, it was the NFL was a very white league back in then. I mean, you think now 75% of the players in the NFL today are African-American. I went back and I looked it up. My Eagles team, I was just thinking off the top of my head, I thought, boy, there aren't many black players on that team. And I went back and I looked it up. Dom, in 1970, they had seven black players on the whole team. That'll just show you how
that's
much.
That's not 1950, 1970.
No, we're not talking 1950 right. now. We're talking 1970. They had seven black players on the team. So that's how much, and the Redskins didn't have any until 1961. The Redskins weren't even integrated until 1961. So the league has changed a lot since then. And the other part of it was, at that time in 1970, hardly any players had agents. I mean, that was an agent? What's that?
Yeah, one of your favorites, Howard Carmichael, he got the call like 2 days later in his dorm room. He was drafted in the 13th round or seventh round, whatever it was.
Seventh round.
It stuns people today, given how businesslike it is. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. And, of course, if you think about 1970, there was no cable TV. There was no ESPN. There was no 24-hour sports talk radio, newspapers were dominant. You know, the news, everybody on a Monday morning ran out to buy the newspaper to read about the game. And Dom, you're from Philly, so you know that the Inquirer and the Bulletin on a Monday during the football season, they had what they called the machine gun photographs. If you remember how they ran across the mm-hmm. page, and you know, you had the football with the dot, with a broken dotted line that followed it from Jurgensen's hand to McDonald's hand. That was our version of ESPN primetime. You know, I mean, there weren't highlight film shows. You couldn't watch the games over again. You couldn't tape them and replay them. So people got to watch the game live on Sunday. And on a Monday, you went out and got the paper, and they would go, I mean, page after page in the newspapers would be all these sequence photos of the big plays of the game. And I remember when I went to work for the Bulletin in 1969 and became the Eagles beat guy in 1970, the circulation manager was telling me the circulation numbers, the unbelievable jump of papers sold on a Monday, that people running out to buy the paper on a Monday mm-hmm. just to see the machine gun sequence photos. Well, now, you know, people get that same stuff on their telephone. 5 minutes yeah. after the game's over, they got all the highlights right here. So you talk about how things have changed in terms of the media and the accessibility of that kind of stuff, and the stats and the pictures and the highlights. I mean, it is a whole different world.
Did you ever think then, because Philadelphia, we talked the other day with Ray, and coming up in your granddad's bar, I know that that's where you got your training. And Ray, there were a lot of people there that loved football, but it seemed to me part of it was baseball. I remember you couldn't find the box scores. There wasn't internet or whatever. So you would look every day in the box score to see, it was a mystery to see how someone had done. So that change, did you ever think the Philadelphia Eagles, though, I would say are on a par almost with some soccer teams that are worldwide? It is beyond any sport or anything we can imagine. I don't see how the other sports are even in the realm, can ever compete in Philadelphia with football again.
Probably not. I think that there's a that this is a football town. You know, I mean, that's just, it's as simple as that. Why? I don't know. There are probably a million reasons. But there are certain places that are just a football town. They just are. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you travel around the country, and I know people here, they hear people say it, and they say, oh, that's just, you know, Phil, that's just local people talking. No, it's not. I mean, if you travel around the country, you go to Boston, okay? And, you know, the real barometer is sports talk radio. You go up there, you get in your rental car, you put on the sports talk station, WBZ. They're talking about the Red Sox. You know, I mean, as good as the Patriots have been, as many Super Bowls as they've won,
right?
You know, Belichick, Brady, the whole thing. I mean, you go up to Boston in October, turn on the radio, they're not talking Brady and Belichick. They're talking Red Sox. You know, good, bad, or indifferent, they're talking Sox. And if they're not talking Sox, they're talking Celtics or they're talking Bruins. Football, I mean, they talk about, if there's a big game coming up, they might talk about it. But Boston is a baseball town. New York is a baseball town. L.A., you looked at, I mean, the Dodgers own Los Angeles. I mean, they've moved two NFL teams back in there in the last mm-hmm. couple of years. And they're not drawn. You know, I mean, the Chargers moved to Los Angeles a couple of years ago, and you saw when the Eagles went out there, the stadium was full of Eagles fans. You know,
yeah, they bring
pro football back to Los Angeles. There's all this fanfare. Oh, boy, we finally have pro football back in L.A. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. They like the Lakers, but they love their Dodgers.
I didn't calculate.
Philadelphia's different. You know, there are a couple towns. There are a couple towns that I would say are football towns. I think Pittsburgh is. Pittsburgh loves the Steelers way more than the Pirates, mm-hmm. more than the Penguins. They don't have basketball. Green Bay, but Green Bay is a different animal because the Packers are all they have. But in a town where you have all four major sports, I think Philly is unique in the sense that football is number one, and it's not even a question of it being number one. I mean, it's number one here, and then everything else is up the track.
Well, some of the most colorful characters, I don't know if it's any coincidence, probably not, but a lot of your book, the stories that stand out to me, other than the wrestling, which we'll get to. And I'm a fan of wrestling. I've interviewed Ric Flair for like a half hour in a principal's office.
I know
due to my sons. So Ray Dininger covering wrestling. We'll get to that. But a lot of the stories, the main ones, the characters we know in the book that jump out, Leonard Toews, Vermeil, Vince Papale. There's a lot of stuff that's really football related in this book. By the way, for everyone, goes without saying, it's a great Father's Day present. And that's the beauty of sports, your dad, and connecting back to your grandfather. So what was it like for Ray Dininger in the bar? Where was the bar? That's a theme throughout here. And what was it like in the bar that led you to want to be a sports writer?
The bar was at 65th and Woodland,
right,
in Southwest Philadelphia. Right across the street from the police station. My parents and I lived in a little apartment over top of a shoe store, one block down Woodland.
Mm-hmm.
We were right between two movie theaters. So on one block on Woodland Avenue, there were two movie theaters on one block. There was the Ben and the Benson. and between the Ben and the Benson, there was a little shoe store, and we lived in an apartment right on top of it. And so there's no park, there's no grass for a little kid to play. So I went down and I hung out at my grandfather's bar from the time.
Oh my God, I can picture it.
I was literally in the bar all day, drinking Cokes and playing shuffleboard and listening to the men talk about sports. And that's all they did. I mean, it was all these guys from the neighborhood that we get together. And it's really funny, Don. I've had so many people ask me, you know, who were your writing influences? You know, who were your biggest influences in terms of learning how to tell a story? And I say my grandfather. You know, before I ever had writing heroes, and I had writing heroes, Stan Hockman, Sandy Grady, those guys.
Right.
But before that, my grandfather was just the greatest storyteller. I refer to him in the book as the Garrison Keillor of Southwest Philadelphia.
Yes.
I mean, that's really how he seemed to me. And his bar was the busiest, most crowded bar on Woodland Avenue for sure. And it was all because, I mean, he was serving the same beer, he was serving the same cold cuts and peanuts in the dish. But people used to come there just to listen to him tell stories. He was a great storyteller. And so I was just this little kid sitting at the end of the bar drinking my Cokes, but listening to my grandfather tell stories. And I really think, you know, I didn't realize it, but I was getting an education in how to tell a story. I think he was probably my first great writing influence without him realizing it or me realizing it.
And the next part that we've heard, and people that know you a little bit are really intrigued, going to your parents good enough, or maybe your dad too wanted to do it, the 2-week vacation, always to Hershey, Pennsylvania, where the Eagles were. And you actually could get up on the field. And of course, then Tommy McDonald, things of that nature happened. And ready to change from that to getting anywhere near, just from a distance and a low, costs $20,000 now, it seems like. So that's a major part of your storytelling and your background, I think, that kind of up close and personal.
No question. No question, Dom. And the really sad part about it is it could never happen now.
Yeah.
It could never happen now. But a big reason why I'm doing what I'm doing, that I've spent 50 years in this business, is because at the age of 8, 9, 10 years old, my parents loved pro football so much that when my dad got his 2 weeks summer vacation from the steel plant, it was never a question where we were going. I mean, we loaded up the car and we drove out to Hershey, Pennsylvania, which was where the Eagles had their training camp back then. And we just went to practice. And we went to practice every day. The picture that's on the screen, that's me. that's me. That's me in 1957 with the great Chuck Bednarik. And my dad snapped that picture. And you talk about up close and personal, this is what it was like. I mean, there just weren't that many people that came to the practices. Number one, it was in Hershey. Hershey Park really didn't exist. I mean, Hershey Park was just, it was a merry-go-round and a and a little roller coaster and a fun house. That was it. It was not a big tourist attraction. You could tour the chocolate factory if you wanted to. And then there were the Eagles. And now there was no security. There were no fences. There were no guards there telling you, stand back, stand back. You could literally walk onto the field and stand on the sideline and talk to the players, you know, while the practice was going on. Or if you were a kid like me, stand outside the locker room and wait for your favorite player to come out and say hi to him, get his autograph. And if you were lucky, as I was, my favorite player was Tommy McDonald. He would hand me his helmet and I would carry his helmet and we would take that walk. It was three blocks from the locker room to the practice field. And I would walk with him and we would have a conversation. And we did that every summer for his entire time with the Philadelphia Eagles.
Unbelievable. Well, I know he's your favorite Eagle of all time. That's what I was telling listeners. The one I regret, I never got around to trying to get an interview with, though. He's not my favorite Eagle of all time. I didn't know him like you did. He's quite a character. It's Chuck Bednarik. I mean, I just can't think of a guy during that period, more of a dominant physical type of player, playing both ways at whatever age he was. The picture of him smoking a cigar and a cigarette and a beer or whatever at the same time. And then poor Frank Gifford standing up. My God, that's pro football. I don't know if there's anything more iconic than that. Chuck Bednarik played against Jim Brown then, right? Or no?
Yes.
He did.
Yes.
Boy, that would be a titanic collision, I would expect.
Yeah, Bednarik had tremendous respect for Brown, and Brown had tremendous respect for Bednarik. But you're right. I very often have people ask me, who's the greatest Eagle player of all time? That question comes up all
the
time.
Yeah.
And I always say, to me, there's three. There's three guys that are sort of on a plateau all by themselves. And if you told me any of those guys was your number one, I really couldn't argue with you. But it's three guys. It's Bednarik, Steve Van Buren, who was the great running back of the 40s.
Right.
And the other one is Reggie White. I mean, those guys are, to my view, the three greatest players that have ever worn an Eagles uniform. And if you were to tell me, you know, Reggie's number one, I'll say, okay. If you say Van Buren's number one, I'm fine with that. If I had to pick one, I would say Chuck. Because I think if you look back in football history, Dom, I think that he is unique. I mean, he comes out of an era in the 1950s. Well, he played in the 40s, actually, through the 50s into the 60s. But in the 40s and 50s, the idea of being a quote-unquote 60-minute man playing both ways was not – I mean, he was not the only guy that did that. I mean, there were other guys that played both ways. But – and I will argue this with anyone. Bednarik is the only player that was the best player in the league at two positions. I mean, there were guys that played both ways, and they were really good at one position, and they just kind of played the other position. When Bednarik played, he was the best center in pro football, and he was the best linebacker in pro football. He was the best player at two positions at the same time, playing 60 minutes of every game. I think that makes him, in my view, unique in NFL history. And while Van Buren was a great player and certainly the linchpin to the two world championship teams of 48-49, and people should know that Van Buren, when Steve retired after the 51 season, he retired as the NFL's all-time leading rusher. Like today, it's Emmitt Smith, and then you've had Jim Brown and these other guys who held the record at some point. But Van Buren was the leading rusher in the history of pro football at the time that he retired. So, I mean, he's right there in terms of being one of the greats. And then there's Reggie, who to me was the best defensive end I've ever seen. So those guys are all in a class by themselves. But if I had to pick one, I would take Bednarik.
Yeah, that's – and then as a media guy, it's Bednarik to me. But it's a great chapter in the book on Reggie White. I was surprised at that. I didn't know how you particularly would get close to Reggie White, but it was a very moving, interesting visiting him when he was studying in Hebrew, things of that nature. Yeah, really an amazing guy. The chapter that I think, though, I want to get to and talk about a little bit is the wrestling, though. It seems so out of character, but not to me. I know you a little bit, and I could see that, them sending you off on that to get to the bottom of it. Fortunately, you never told one of these guys, as John Stossel, who I've interviewed with, it, come on, this is all fake. And then the guy takes his ear off almost in this. But the insight of you, back when sports, local sports, would send people on the budget off for weeks, it seems like, that's a change to cover wrestling. So why did they do that? Why was that such a big deal to you? And they sent Ray Dininger to do it.
Well, it was the only time in all the years that I worked in the business, it was the only time that I had a fight with my boss. It was the only time that I actually had a shouting match with my boss. And it was over that. You're right. I mean, it was 1985, 84, 85, at a time when there was really a wrestling boom. I mean, wrestling was really exploding. You know, they had just had the first WrestleMania. Wrestling was all over cable TV. The ratings were through the roof. I mean, they had wrestling on cable TV and it was outdrawing college football 3-1. I mean, it wasn't even close. So there was this tremendous surge in popularity for professional wrestling. They were having shows at the Spectrum and selling out the Spectrum. I mean, jammed, couldn't get another person in the building. So the sports editor with the Daily News, I was working at the Daily News then, it was a fellow named Mike Raffin, great sports editor, really good sports editor. And he and I got along fine most of the time. But he had this, it was at that time, like 84, 85, when none of the teams right. in Philly were that good. And listen, the Daily News, you know, we got to put something good on the cover because the Daily News has to sell itself every day. You know, we're not a subscription paper where it's getting dropped on your doorstep. I mean, you got to give people a reason to put their money down and buy it. So they're always looking for sports stories, hot sports stories to put on the front page. And, you know, Marion Campbell? No. John Felsky? I don't think so. They weren't yeah. selling a lot of papers. So Mike got this idea, hey, you know, pro wrestling, this is hot. Let's go. Let's have a big series, a full, not just one story now, Dom. A whole right. week, a whole series of stories about the explosion in pro wrestling. And so Mike called me in his office one day and said, what do you know about wrestling? And I said, what are you talking about? Like, you know, Hulk Hogan and that stuff.
Yeah.
What do you, I said, nothing. I don't pay attention to that. And he said, well, you know, it's red hot, you know, and I knew Mike well. And I thought, uh-oh, I know where this is going. He wants to do a big story on pro wrestling and I guess it's me, you know. And so he started saying, you know, we really want to do this. I said, Mike, no. I said, it doesn't belong in sports. I said, it's not a sport. It's not. It's. I said, if you want to put it in the paper, the popularity, okay, I kind of get it. But let the features department do it. You know, the people that do movies and television and you right. know, let them handle it. It's not a. It doesn't belong in the sports section. And Mike said, no, we're going to do it. And he said, and you're going to do it. And I said, no, get somebody else. I'm not interested. You know, I don't want to do it. He said, no, you're doing it. I said, Mike, I don't want to do it. I'm normally a pretty easy guy to get along with, but I have no interest in it. Anything else. We went around and around and wound up with him, you know, him pointing his finger and I'm the boss. You work for me. You're doing this series. So, I mean, I really did it under duress and, I had no choice. So you put the schedule up and I had it and it was my baby and I had to write it. But you know what? I think he was right. It turned out to be a much better series than I ever imagined that it could be. I mean, I certainly went into it with great misgivings, but what we came out with was pretty good. I mean, it got picked up. The series got the Associated Press bought the series and it got picked up in more than 200 newspapers around the country. I never had anything I wrote get picked up
yeah.
and circulated as widely as that. So for all my protestations and for all of my right. complaining and stomping my feet, I have to admit that Mike Raffin was right. There was a story there.
I found it to be the chapter you put in there, the stuff you got from these guys, what it was like, what they didn't get paid. You know, the guys that weren't Hulk Hogan. Was riveting stuff, and it was an honest look at how athletically good these guys are, even though it's fixed and the moves to try to make that real. And I love how you brought up you need a villain. We all need those storylines in sports, and you need the good guy. I'm glad you put it in the book. Now, I wanted to talk, Ray, the book, of course, Finish Business. What's the best way to get the book? It's available all over the place, right? That's the best thing you'd recommend?
Yes, it is available all over the place. Unfortunately, Amazon, well, a lot of people order everything on Amazon now. And there's been such a demand for it, probably tied to Father's Day, that Amazon right now is sold out. Amazon is sold out.
Oh,
so if people want to get the book, want to get the book, you kind of have to go to a bookstore and find it.
Right. I've never heard that. Has ever happened with your book before? A book you've written a lot of. Gee.
Yeah. It happened with Eagles Encyclopedia after the Eagles won the Super Bowl.
Yeah, right.
The Champions Edition.
Yeah.
That sold like crazy, which you would imagine. I mean, anything with the Eagles logo on it was selling like mad then.
Right.
But yeah, it happened again. So I've got a book signing coming up tomorrow at the Barnes & Noble in Broomall in the Lawrence Park Shopping Center. I'll be there at 5:00 tomorrow signing copies of the book, and I know they have copies. And I also will have another one on Saturday at the Barnes & Noble in Wilmington. Same thing. That'll be at 2:00, and they have the books in store. So if you're looking for a book, don't go to Amazon right now. You'll have to go to an actual bookstore and get a copy. But
well,
I'll be signing tomorrow
the Broomall
and then Saturday in Wilmington.
If you want to get it for your dad, you inscribe it to him too. That is a great, that's a tremendous Father's Day gift, because there's so many things in here. I think, and I wanted to go back when you say headlines, heroes, and heartaches. Being a Philadelphia sports fan is a tremendous amount of that heartache. And I guess we got over it with the Phillies when they won and broke that jinx. And then Nick Foles. I'm kind of surprised. No Nick Foles stuff. Now, we have a running joke you may know in the show. I have Nick Foles fervor second to none. I've never seen a guy like this stand, you know, when we did a big
Stop it, Dom.
All right, Dan.
Please. Nick Foles.
He couldn't have been nicer to the producers, everything else. He said, hey, can we go play some basketball with me? I can imagine injuring Nick Foles. But the fervor, the craziness over this, it wasn't just that the Eagles won and it propelled you to this. It was the manner in which the Philly special, Foles, and beating Brady and Belichick. You just can't ask for anything more. But I wanted to go back and ask you about some of the other characters here. Leonard Toews. I don't know if people of a certain age don't even know who Leonard Toews is. But the difference, say, of a Jeffrey Lurie versus a Leonard Toews sort of thing, maybe to me, Ray, symbolizes the corporate big giant now with Jeffrey Lurie and the Eagles, even extremely big in town, that Leonard Toews operating by the seat of his pants, it appeared to be, which he lost in Atlantic City any number of times.
Right.
And we talked the other day, there ought to be a movie, you ought to write it, the screenplay of Leonard Toews. People would not believe that. Is he kind of the quintessential NFL owner of a certain era, Toews?
He was, but in saying that, he was also unique. He was a dashing, flamboyant, extravagant, outrageous guy who his father, you know, his father, you know, his chapter, I call it the peddler's son. His father was a Russian immigrant, literally a street peddler in Bridgeport, Norristown, started, you know, with a pack on his back, selling goods in the streets, bought one truck, then bought two trucks and three trucks, and worked his way up to when there was literally a Toews trucking company, to where they were the largest trucking company on the whole East Coast. And they became millionaires. And Leonard and his brother ran the company after his father passed away. And they're very wealthy guys. And Leonard was an original investor with the Eagles on a relatively small scale. But when Jerry Wallman went bankrupt and had to sell the team, Leonard Toews stepped up and said, hey, I'll buy the whole thing. And he did. And then he just came in and, you know, really transformed it with largely the strength of his own personality. I mean, he was He was larger than life. I mean, he was Gatsby. He was all of that stuff. I mean, he drove around town in a chauffeur-driven Rolls Royce. He had his own private helicopter that he that had Eagles wings painted on it. When he went up to the training camp, which was then at Albright College in Reading, he would fly in. The team would be on the practice field practicing, and over the mountain in Reading, it's either and here comes the owner in his private helicopter with the Eagle wings, lowering, coming down, that have to stop practice. All the players and coaches would get off the field, and the owner's helicopter would land at the 50-yard line, and
Leonard
would come out in his tailored in his Italian suit and his Italian loafers, and in the swirling dust, he'd wave to the crowd, and it was quite the scene. You know, and he lived in high style, married four times. You know, I never saw him. This is true, Dom. I never saw him tip anybody less than $50. And usually it was $100. Yeah. I mean, he thought nothing of a bartender pouring him one drink and he would give the guy $100. Thought nothing of it. That was the way he lived. He was very good in terms of charity. He started the Eagles Fly for Leukemia, which helped, that was originally to help one of his players whose daughter, baby daughter, had leukemia. They started Eagles Fly for Leukemia to help pay their medical expenses. And then they just kept growing it. And they kept growing it to where, you know, Children's Hospital now in Philadelphia, they have a whole wing that the Eagles have built. And then they spun that off into the Ronald McDonald Houses, where the families of kids that had leukemia that were being treated at CHOP, they could come stay at the Ronald McDonald House at no charge. That all started with the Eagles and it started with Leonard Toews. So, I mean, he had a really good heart. And, you know, he wrote checks for every good cause you could imagine. But he also had, he was an alcoholic and he had a gambling addiction. And ultimately, you know, he always thought that he had enough money and enough friends that it would never come back and take him down. But ultimately, once they opened the casinos in Atlantic City, there was really no saving him. And in the end, he wound up losing everything. It wound up being, you know, it's hard to imagine that he reached that point, but he did. And finally, in his later years, and I write about it in the book, he lost his home, lost his fortune, and was living alone in a hotel room in Philadelphia with Dick Vermeil paying his bills.
Unbelievable. But the thing, too, that would never happen today, I thought you couldn't possibly do this, that's a big picture with Toews, actually, and I thought I knew this, but you write in the book in a lot of detail, was closer than I thought to moving the team out of the city, moving the Eagles out of here. I thought, remember it. I think Wilson Good was the mayor, maybe stuff going on.
He was.
You try to do that today, Ray. Can you imagine on WIP, Angelo opening up, it looks like the Eagles are talking about moving out of town. What might happen to you? And it was that close.
It was. I mean, it came that close. I knew nothing of it. I mean, I was covering the team. I was around the team. Didn't get a whiff of it. I mean, we all knew that Leonard was in desperate financial straits.
Right.
We all knew that. But the idea that there were these negotiations going on to move the team, nobody knew that. The story broke in Arizona. An Arizona reporter got wind of it, and he broke the story. I was sound asleep in bed. My phone rang. I picked it up. The overnight sports editor said, do you know anything about the Eagles moving to Arizona?
What?
And then he read me the story, and it was basically, hey, the negotiations are going on, and it's all but done. There were quotes from politicians out in Arizona talking about what a great thing this was going to be for Arizona. They always wanted pro football and they were going to get this team. And Dom, I mean, it was like this, close. We had, it was, the story broke the final week of the regular season, in 84. It was the final week of the season. The Eagles were going nowhere. They were playing a game down in Atlanta against a bad Falcon team. It was just your basic playing out the string scenario. But all of a sudden, this story breaks on Tuesday. And now, for the whole week, it really looks like that game in Atlanta is going to be the last game for the Philadelphia Eagles. That after that game, they're moving and they're going to be the Arizona Eagles next year. And that all of a sudden, that game that had no meaning, all of a sudden had enormous meaning because it looked like the last game the Eagles were going to play in Philadelphia. And a whole bunch of people from Philadelphia bought plane tickets to fly down there to be there for the last game. Now, as you mentioned, Wilson Good, the NFL owners, Pete Rozelle, all those people got involved, and they worked out this deal at literally at the 11th hour and announced it on Saturday that, no, we're not moving. We're going to stay. We got the lease rewritten at the vet. They're going to put in the super boxes. We'll get all the money. So, yeah, we can stay here now. And so when they actually went out and played the game on Sunday, the whole moving to Arizona thing had gone away. But for the better part of a week, it really looked like the Philadelphia Eagles were all but gone from Philadelphia.
What's the favorite part of the book, Ray, that we haven't talked about that you point people to? Is there another chapter, another personality, somebody else that you wrote about? I know we didn't talk Papale, but who else?
Broad Street Bullies.
The
Broad Street Bullies. Prior to Super Bowl 52, prior to the Eagles and Nick Foles winning the Super Bowl, when people would ask me, all the years that you've been here, all the stories you've written, you know, what was the most fun? What was the highlight? Now I would say the Super Bowl, obviously. But before that, hands down, it was the Broad Street Bullies and the two Stanley Cups. Because I think you kind of have to, well, they were fun. I mean, they were just fun to be around. A great group of guys, most of whom still live here. Most of them still live in this area.
Oh, absolutely.
I think, and you being a Philadelphia guy and having been here this whole time, I mean, you know how bad the sports situation was in Philadelphia in the early 70s. The Phillies were terrible. The Eagles team that I was covering was terrible. The Sixers had just come off that season where they only won 9 games. And the Flyers were the new team in town, and they weren't all that good. We were being referred to as the city of losers. And justly so, we were. But then all of a sudden, man, 73, 74, here come the Broad Street Bullies. And took the NHL by storm. They're only in their 7th year of existence, and yet they run off not one, but back-to-back Stanley Cups and really, really energized the city. And, you know, I really do think that they, hockey was still fairly unknown in Philadelphia. And most of the people in Philadelphia didn't really know hockey. They didn't understand icing, offsides, what, I don't understand. But the Broad Street Bullies, the way they played, Philly could understand that. They might not understand all the nuances of hockey.
Like all the way the kids, fans all those kids in the suburbs getting a net and playing suddenly hockey. You saw it. My most fun guy, Ray, I know the goon stuff and all. I had occasion twice to have Bob Kelly at a remote broadcast 20 years after this, people coming up. When he would come on the ice and just look at where the puck was, running into his own guys, running into whatever. Anybody that ever sees footage of that, it's not goon stuff. It's just something fun and energetic that you can't describe.
Yeah. Oh, it's exactly right. I mean, that whole team, Moose DuPont, Dave the Hammer Schultz, Big Bird Seletsky, the Hound, Bob Kelly, you talk about him, Clarkie, Perron. Yeah. They were fun to watch. They weren't fun to play against, but they were certainly fun to watch. And I really think that they lifted the cloud off the city. You know, I mean, for a town that couldn't win, none of the teams were any good. I mean, the teams that were in town then, it went beyond being just bad. They were like laughingstock bad. And the Flyers came in and they changed everything. You know, when they won those two cups and there were the two big parades and it just gave a surge of energy to this town that all the other teams sort of got on that wave, you know? And right after that, you know, the Eagles bring in Dick Vermeil. The Phillies go get Pete Rose. The Sixers go get Dr. J. And all of a sudden, within a couple of years, and certainly by the end of the decade, all those teams, they were all playing for championships. But I think that the Flyers winning those cups really kind of got that momentum going, that by the end of the decade, all of the teams were riding it.
I'll ask you in a moment. I know it's a hard one. The all-time Philadelphia athlete, if you took two or three of them for whatever reasons. But I guess Hugh didn't start. He wasn't here then. 67 championship. The all-time favorite to me, I almost the guy was sick, the morning drive guy at WWDB, so they told me to be in the bullpen. We had Oliver North at the height of Iran-Contra coming in at 7. The very height of it with a book. They used to do tours then. And then at 8, the big guy walked in. When Oliver North walked out, it was like a nobody. You know, a guy could have been a bum walking in there, because Wilt came walking down that same narrow corridor. A guy gave him an orange to sign. Stuff like that was going on. But you were a little bit too late to cover Wilt Chamberlain.
Wilt was, as a fan, I certainly saw him. And I remember, I very well remember that Sixers team. It's still, to my way of thinking, one of the greatest teams I've ever seen. The team with Wilt, Cunningham, Chet Walker, Hal Greer, Wally Jones.
Luke Jackson.
That was one of the best teams. Listen, a team that has Billy Cunningham as a sixth man. Damn right, that's a great team. I mean, if you got him coming off the bench, you know, Wilt was just, I mean, he was a singular figure to this day. I mean, if you look at the records that he set, the achievements, the way he changed, one man changed the game. I mean, they changed the rules because of Wilt. I mean, certainly one of the most impactful athletes that we've seen in any sport. And, you know, homegrown Philly guy that, you know, will all, whether people, you know, people, young people today never saw him, but they all know who he was. And they were certainly fun to watch. I mean, those games, and I know you're a big basketball guy. I mean, it was, my father really loved pro basketball. He loved the Eagles most, but he loved pro basketball. And very often we would go to Convention Hall to see the Celtics and, the Warriors first, and then the Sixers. And those games between Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell, man, that was one of the great rivalries of all time, to watch those two guys go head to head.
Well, if you're okay, Dan is mocking us. I'm such a basketball guy. Ben Simmons has not missed his first foul shot of the night yet because the Sixers haven't started yet. So there you go. But Ray, your favorite athletes over those 50 years, give me three of them if you could, for whatever reason. They may not be the biggest, the best, or whatever, but there's something about them. I mean, I have the quintessential, and they're personal here to Philly. You got the greatest play in Philadelphia sports, one of the greatest, and I even forget the name of the outfielder, the center fielder for the Phillies, who ran into the cyclone fence, broke his nose,
and
Aaron Rowland, and held up the ball. That is the second best. The best, of course, is Pete Rose running behind Bob Boone. Boone bobbles a pop-up catcher, and Rose is there at first base. Not only catches it, but the way he threw it back around the infield and all, it's Rose, ultimately, is right up there. So how about you? What are some of the things that are the real highlights of all this?
Well, if you said three, you know, Tommy McDonald's clearly number one.
I know. I take that. Yeah.
You know, my boyhood hero, the guy I carried his helmet every summer.
And got into the Hall of Fame. You were responsible. Yep.
Yeah. I sort of led the drive to, you know, led the campaign to finally get Tommy into the Hall of Fame. And then he asked me to be his presenter. And there we are at Canton, Tommy, me, and his bust. And to Dom, I don't know how to describe that feeling. I to be in that parade, that Hall of Fame parade, riding through the streets of Canton in an open convertible, 250,000 people on the sidewalk.
Wow.
And you're riding in an open convertible with your boyhood hero, and you're on your way to the Hall of Fame, and you're going to give his presentation speech. Man, talk about dreams coming true. That was it for me. So Tommy's number one. Two, in the book, I felt like I had to pick the greatest athlete that I covered in 50 years in Philly. I felt like it would be a cop-out not to do that.
Right.
So I picked Mike Schmidt. I think that it was you know, it's when you're in the business, when you're in the sports writing business, you see, you accept it's just a matter of course that any game you go to, any field you look over, those guys, they're the best. You know, they're the best. Or forever, whatever high school or college they came from, you know, that they're gods in that town. And so everybody that's on the field playing professionally, they're the best. But sometimes certain guys rise above that. And you realize sometimes you're watching them and you say, you know what? I think I'm watching the best that ever was. You know, and, you know, I felt that way about Michael Jordan. I felt that way about certain guys. But in Philadelphia, there are only two people that when I watched them, I felt like I'm watching the greatest ever. And one of them was Reggie. As I said, I think he's the greatest defensive end I ever saw. But the other one is Mike Schmidt. I watched him every game he played for all the years in Philadelphia. And I said, you know what? I'm watching the best third baseman that's ever laced up a pair of spikes. He was. I mean,
that's why he couldn't manage. Can you imagine Mike Schmidt seeing a guy, you know, average? Mike Schmidt doesn't tolerate that. I mean, yeah, I agree with you. And he was complicated relationship with Philadelphia again. Very complicated.
Yeah, he did. He did. And still does to some degree. But I mean, if you look at his accomplishments, he was so great that we really kind of took him for granted. It wasn't until I was writing the book and I went back and got the stat book out and started looking. I said, oh, my God, yes, sir. The numbers just blew me away. Do you realize, I tell people this and they say, no, that can't be. Realize he led the National League in home runs 8 times.
Wow.
He was the National League home run champion 8 times. Only one other player in baseball history won his league championship in home runs more than that. And it wasn't Barry Bonds, I'll tell you that much.
Babe Ruth.
It was Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're talking about a guy that led their league in home runs the most, it's Babe Ruth in the American League, and it's Mike Schmidt in the National League.
And yet in Philadelphia, as we said, he made it look too easy.
And people in Philadelphia, I think they do appreciate it.
Yeah.
But one of the real fun parts of the book, and you've referred to the book a few times, one of the most fun things in the book was when I got at the end of their careers, the summer that both Mike Schmidt and Rich Ashburn were getting ready to go to Cooperstown to be enshrined, I sat the two of them down for an interview for an hour and a half. I had Mike Schmidt and Rich Ashburn alone, myself, in an empty locker room down at Joe Robbie Stadium in Miami. Right. And I just sat there with them, and for 2 hours, I just put the tape recorder on and let them talk about baseball. And man, you talk about fun. That was so much fun to listen to Whitey talk about his era and Schmidty talk about his career. It was great. I mean, I just sat back and just enjoyed it. So
I think that is such a great choice, because you agree the hardest act in sports still is and always will be hitting a baseball.
Yes. Yes. Well, Richie certainly believed that.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Richie always argued that baseball players are the greatest athletes. We would have these discussions in the press room all the time. And Richie always argued, and he was saying, you're going to say football, pointing at me. Yeah, you're going to say football. And, you know, you other guys would say basketball, but, you know, who's the greatest? And somebody said, Michael Jordan's the greatest athlete. Yeah. How good did Michael Jordan do when he decided to play baseball? It sort of fortified Richie's argument, you know?
Yeah.
Now, like, I don't think baseball players are the greatest athletes. So you just look at them and you kind of see that.
I think pro golfers are, but not just kidding. Yeah.
I thought that Schmidt, in terms of the all around part of the game, I mean, in terms of being able to field, run, hit with power, all of that stuff. Schmidt was in a class by himself. And then the third guy, you said three, the other one to me would be Bobby Clark. I don't think I ever saw an athlete that was a greater natural leader, a guy that was more inspirational night in and night out, or a guy that played as hard night in and night out as Clark did. I mean, you talk about a guy who never took a night off. Bobby Clark never took a night off. He wouldn't know how to do it.
Let's see. Larry Carlin would like to know whether Tommy and me is going to come to Westchester.
I don't know. We are planning on, in fact, we just talked this week about trying to get Tommy and me back together again, get the actors together. They want to do it. The director, Joe Canuso, wants to do it. And there are some theaters that are have been in contact with us about doing it. Right now, it looks like most likely, not for sure, we haven't signed the papers, but it looks like most likely we're going to be at the Delaware Theater Company in Wilmington in October. Right now, that seems to be pretty firm. They really want to do it. Our guys really want to do it. They just have to clear their schedules. But I think we're probably going to bring Tommy and me to the Delaware Theater Company in the fall. And I'm really looking forward to it. I missed doing it last year. We did it for 4 years in a row. We started it in 2016. Then we did it in 17, 18, and 19. And last year, of course, because of COVID, everything shut down. And I missed it.
Oh, I tell you, it was a great honor asked to moderate the question and answer afterward, which is just magical what happens in that, really. And it's so well done, so insightful, so much fun. So we want to promote that as soon as you know, right? About that.
I think, it's not for sure, but it looks like it's probably going to come. And I've been to a couple plays at Delaware Theater Company. It's really a lovely theater, pretty big too. It's over 400 seats. And it'll be a great home for Tommy. I hope that happens. And if we get it all firmed up and it's for sure, I will certainly let you know.
One parting comment too, certainly worthy the Hall of Fame for you. It's just an honor that's, starting at the Delco Times and ending up the Hall of Fame and just so treasured in Philadelphia, including I have my yellow legal pad here, but I use them. When you write those things down, people said, you got to ask Ray, what the heck are you writing? How does Ray Dininger know how to evaluate football talent, like offensive linemen? He has good feet and all that type of stuff. Where did that come from? People really would like to have you as general manager.
Yeah, I know that comes up. people, it's funny. It's always when the team's going badly, when they're winning the Super Bowl, nobody wants me to be general manager, but when they're sort of the chalk outline on the sidewalk, and they're putting up the yellow tape around them, that's when all of a sudden get Ray in here.
Have you ever been asked, was it ever and even reasonably close?
No. People ask me a lot. Have you ever had opportunities for them to bring you into the front office as a consultant? No, hasn't happened.
I would go with the Sixers right now, right? I trade Ben Simmons before tonight's opening tip-off. I'm constrained here. Yeah,
I know you would. I know you would. You're not alone in feeling that way. Dom, in 1970, when I first started covering the team, I was just this kid, 23 years old, at training camp, really in over my head. And I had a coach on the team, a guy named Charlie Gower.
Oh, yeah.
Was an assistant coach on the team. After a week of reading my stories, Charlie pulled me aside one day and he said, you seem like a very nice boy. And I can tell you're trying really hard. He said, but, you really don't know much about football. And he said, every night I'm in my dorm room watching film. And if, it's up to you, but if you want to just drop in one night, maybe I can show you a few things. So that summer, Charlie left the door open for me and I came in and I watched film with him every night. And he really taught me the game. I mean, he really taught me, how the game was played and, think that he made the mistake, but it really wasn't his fault. It was the other guys. He really took me inside the game in a way that, really helped. And from that point on, I really became more of a student of the game. And now I like to think that after 50 years, I know a little bit. The one time, I'll say this, as far as being a general manager, I only have tried to be a general manager one time. One time. And I write about it in the book. It was 1974. It was the 15th round of the draft. Everybody stopped paying attention long ago. And I took Mike McCormick aside. Mike was the coach of the team and a very nice fellow. And Mike and I got along really well. And presumptuous it was. I pulled him aside and I said, "Hey, Mike, this round, why don't you draft Billy White Shoes Johnson?" For the kid from Widener. He said, "He's too small." And I said, "Mike, it's the 15th round. I mean, what do you got to lose? I mean, you're drafting baton swirlers at this point. I mean, I've seen this kid play since he was at Chichester High School. I'm telling you, he can play." "Nah, too small." And I said, "Mike, I guarantee you he can at the very least be a kick returner in the NFL. Probably too small to be a halfback, but he could certainly be a kick returner, maybe even a receiver." No, too small." Well, the next round, the Houston Oilers take Billy White Shoes Johnson, and everybody remembers the career that he had. He wound up retiring as the all-time leading punt returner in the history of the NFL, and I never let Mike McCormick forget that.
That's a great insight. Ray, thanks for being so generous with this. And again, it's a joy as a broadcaster to hear you and Glenn every weekend on WIP. Now, people that can't get the book on Amazon, hopefully that will be coming up pretty soon. They'll restock. Tomorrow, you're going to be in Broomall at the Barnes & Noble in Broomall, right? At what time?
The Barnes & Noble in Broomall, Lawrence Park Shopping Center, tomorrow at 5 o'clock.
Okay.
And then I will be at the Barnes & Noble in Wilmington on 202 on Saturday at 2 o'clock.
Great stuff, Ray. It is a joy. Thank you so much for doing this. Anytime, you're, of course, welcome on our show. I just have to move you a little bit more toward basketball. That's the only thing that it – but other than that, you are the man. Thank you, Ray. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Don. This has been a real pleasure and, you know, happy to join you anytime.
Thank you, Ray. Hey, thanks, everyone. Thanks for watching tonight. Ray Dittinger, the book, Finish Business, is a tremendous Father's Day gift without a doubt or any time of the year. And Dan Borowski, thank you. Thanks for the coaching. I'm off to see the Sixers win tonight on a Ben Simmons foul shot at the end of the game. Thanks, Ray. We'll talk soon. Thanks,
thank
everybody,
you,
for watching
Take
tonight.
Care. Thank
Good
you
night,
very
everybody.
Much.
Dom Giordano, weekdays 9 till noon on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.